Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Welcome to the Deeper Waters Podcast. I'm Nick Peters, seeking to bring you the very best in apologetics information, and today is no exception. When I started sharing the news about what was going to be on this show, and now people realized they'd have to wait till it came out on iTunes, there were so many people saying, I don't want to wait, let's play it now. Well, now the time has come. Today, we are going to be talking about a real hot topic. We are going to be talking about the concept of God in the Old Testament, and is God a moral monster? Well, who better to discuss this than the person who wrote the book, Is God a Moral Monster, Paul Copan. Now, who is Paul Copan? Well, according to his bio, he's got a PhD in philosophy from Marquette University. He's professor and pleasure family chair of philosophy and ethics at Palm Beach Atlantic University. And he served as president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society. He's the author and editor of 30 books, including The Rationality of Theism, The Rutledge Companion to Philosophy of Religion, Philosophy of Religion, Classic and Contemporary Issues, The Gospel and the Marketplace of Ideas, An Introduction to Biblical Ethics, Is God a Moral Monster, and True for You, but Not for Me. He has contributed essays to over 30 books, both scholarly and popular. He and his wife, Jacqueline, have 6 children, and they reside in West Palm Beach, Florida. His website is paulcopan.com. So, Dr. Copan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Very good to be with you, Nick.
Very good to have you here. That was an academic intro that we have for you, but if people don't know you well, what's a little bit about your story and how you got to be doing what you're doing?
All right. Well, I grew up in a Christian home, but it wasn't until high school that I started to see the very clear objective foundations for the Christian faith, that it wasn't simply a faith that I believe or ought to believe because my parents passed it on to me, but rather it was something that I could own for myself. It was something that was objectively true, and the more I studied, say, the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus or the trustworthiness of the scriptures, I began to see how the Christian faith was something that was objectively true. It was something that was good news for all people. It wasn't just true for me, but not necessarily for other people. And so this was a remarkable revelation to me, that it was something that really took hold of me in a new way when I was in high school. And so in college, I did a undergraduate degree in biblical studies and then went on to Trinity Seminary to get a Master Divinity degree. But when I was there at Trinity Seminary, I took a class with the evangelical philosopher Stuart Hackett. That was my first semester there, and it was a class called Religious Epistemology and the Study of Knowledge. And it opened up my eyes to new ways of thinking. It helped me to see how the Christian faith answers many of the common objections that people raise about the way things are, how we can know, etc. And so it was an eye-opening class for me, and so I decided to not only get a Master of Divinity, but also a Master of Arts in Philosophy of Religion. And also, while I was at Trinity Seminary, I took classes with William Lane Craig, and so that was a wonderful relationship that has blossomed into a real partnership in which Bill Craig and I have teamed up in writing and co-editing books together. And so it's been, and also being leader in the leadership of the Evangelical Philosophical Society. But going back a little bit, when I was on staff of the church in New York and getting to know college students and engaging with their ideas, it was very helpful for me to see how, again, the Christian faith was able to address the questions that they were asking. It did a better job of addressing questions than their own worldviews were offering. And so through that experience with college students, I saw the increasing value of having this kind of a background and to pursue a further degree would be really a marvelous capstone for this pursuit. And so it's actually my wife who encouraged me to consider getting a PhD. And so we had four children at the time. Our fifth one was born in Wisconsin after I went to Marquette University. And it was just a marvelous time of, again, building on what I had experienced. And then I had gotten to meet Ravi Zacharias while I was living in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, we stayed in contact, and he invited me to come on staff with him to speak on university campuses and also to teach at various seminaries in the area of apologetics and philosophy. And so I did that. I was on staff for 5.5 years with... I
think I remember that.
Yeah. And so anyway, that one thing led to another, and then through publications and so forth would eventually, and teaching would eventually come to Palm Beach Atlantic University, mm-hmm. where I am now. I've been here for 10 years, and so it's been a great opportunity for writing, for researching, for speaking, for leadership in the Evangelical Philosophical Society. So that's a little bit of the unfolding of my own path in philosophy of religion and apologetics.
Yeah, for those who are curious of what I was just saying, that the first time I got to meet you was, in fact, at RZIM when I came down there one day to meet Ravi, and you were there.
Hmm.
I'm not sure if you remember that, but I do.
Okay, well, I've met a lot of people coming through. When I'd seen you... a few years ago, I don't know if you mentioned that to me, but that's very interesting.
Yeah. And also, something amusing I've heard about Faminoff for you is that I've heard you have a cat named Renee.
Well, we used to. That was the cat that we had in New York, yes. It was named after the philosopher Rene Descartes. So we called him Rene Descartes. Mm-hmm. And had his claws removed as a little kitten, we thought of calling him Rene de Claude, but we decided not. Another name in the running was Emmanuel Cat, but we decided to stick with Rene.
Yeah. Okay, well, I found a lot of your books on the popular level are really some of the best books out there for those kinds of topics, such as True for You but Not for Me, and How Do You Know You're Not Wrong, When God Goes to Starbucks, books like that, because these are really addressing what the people on the street are hearing, what they're hearing on the internet, and they're short enough chapters that someone can go and get a general feel of a topic, but they also point to leading works beyond them. Would you care to comment on why you've taken that approach?
Well, the book that I began it all, so to speak, was True for You but Not for Me, which was published back in 1998, just as I started working with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the value of putting something together that was accessible to people who had questions about how to respond to relativism, how do you respond to religious pluralism. And so it was actually a larger book that I had envisioned, or at least a book that was in larger chunks. And then the publisher, or the editor at Bethany House Publishers, suggested maybe breaking up my very large chapters into smaller, accessible, and self-contained ones so that I could, in a sense, make it more of a handbook for people, and they could dip in according to the particular slogan that they heard, like, that's true for you but not for me, or... all religions are basically the same, or something like that. And so I revised the book, and it really did well. People seemed to gravitate toward that approach. It was a good way of bridging the I was trying to work in the scholarly area, but also translate that into a more popular, accessible manner. And so I just built on that in future volumes. And so I just had, When God Goes to Starbucks, How Do You Know You're Not Wrong? That's Just Your Interpretation. Those were books that follow the same sort of format of self-contained chapters, having bullet points at the end of the chapters, and then recommended reading at the end of those chapters as well. So those have, in a sense, connected with people, and people have expressed appreciation that it helps to translate some maybe harder to understand concepts into ways that they can think about them, grasp them, and then give them further resources for further exploration.
Okay. So how do we then get to a book like Is God a Moral Monster, which seems to be rather a long book on one topic in particular? What led to the writing of this book?
Well, the topic of Old Testament ethical challenges has been one that I've been interested in, and of course, there are certain questions about the ancient Near East and how it seems that there's such a different mindset, a different way of thinking about things, and how do we think about those in our modern 21st century world? And so I actually started to read some of these new atheists like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and so on, and saw a common theme, namely complaints against the God of the Old Testament. And so what prompted me to launch into a book project was actually, first the response to an article that I wrote in Philosophia Christi, a journal of the Evangelical Philosophical Society. And it was on the topic, again, is Yahweh a moral monster? And then I was dealing with various themes in the Old Testament. I addressed in a sense, seed form, some of these themes, such as the Old Testament laws regarding slavery / servitude or warfare in the Old Testament. And what I tried to do was to make some philosophical and ethical sense of these commands, of the context, putting that in its proper place. And again, trying to help build that bridge or bridge that gap from the ancient Near East to today. And then there was a book symposium that came, symposium that came later on in Philosophia Christi, and it was on the topic, did God mandate genocide? And so there are a few critics of my view, and then I offered a couple of supporters as well. And basically, I had a summary response to all of these questioners and critics, and that would eventually lead to my working on the book Is God a Moral Monster? So I had a lot of good material to work with, and so I was able to deal with topics such as warfare in the Old Testament, servitude in the Old Testament, those strange laws that we come across in the Old Testament, the kosher laws and so forth, and what about those punishments that we see in the Old Testament, capital punishment for this or that, and also trying to address the topic, are women considered inferior in the Old Testament, and then bringing some of the questions to a head and dealing with the topic, does religion cause violence? And then I, at the end of the book, look at actually how the Christian faith has made an impact. It's kind of ironic that those critics, like the new atheists, who are launching criticisms against the Christian faith, it's actually the Christian faith that has actually laid the foundations for human rights and human dignity, democracy and so many other gains in the West have their roots in the Christian faith, not in the Enlightenment, not in Greek democracy, but actually, which is actually not genuine democracy, if you look closely. But again, it's very interesting to see that you have the very roots of our moral thinking that has been shaped, again, through Scripture. A lot of these critics are now, in a sense, turning their backs on these influences and lashing out at, quote, the God of the Old Testament, and in a sense, forgetting their heritage, And so what I try to do is put that into a proper context for understanding where we've come from, and to indeed show some of the hypocrisy that is behind some of those criticisms that have been launched by the new atheists and others.
I understand with some of your other critics, you've got a book coming out in the near future, I'm guessing, with Matthew Flanagan on this topic, right?
That is correct, yes. It's a book coming out in October with Baker Books, and the book is entitled, Did God Really Command Genocide? And this will be a full-length treatment of the topic of violence in the Old Testament. We look at a whole range of topics. We look at the and again, probably some of the stuff we'll get into a little bit later on, but we look at you know, some of the criticisms that are launched by, say, Raymond Bradley, an atheist philosopher. We'll look at some of the, you know, what does it mean for the Bible to be the Word of God? Because a lot of times people think, oh, God commanded this, therefore this is God's command to us. And a lot of people will make that faulty jump to the present, saying, well, if God commanded it back then, he could do that now. And we look more closely at the topic, well, what does it mean for the Bible to be the Word of God? And we also have a chapter in there on the topic, is the God of the Old Testament the same as the God of the New? And so we look at a couple of Old Testament scholars, Eric Seibert and Peter Enns, who really, they form quite a chasm between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New. And what we try to do is say, you know, actually the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ is one who is both kind and severe, the very God that we see in the Old Testament. So the Jesus who says, love your enemies, is the same one who says that if someone leads one of these little ones astray, it would be better for him to have a millstone tied around his neck and for him to be drowned in the depths of the sea. Yes, that's the Jesus who said, love and pray for your enemies. So it's important to keep those things in mind, and that when we come to Jesus, we're not looking at someone who is radically different or is espousing a radically different God from the God of the Old Testament. In fact, he talks about punishments, you know, that the one who dishonors his father and mother shall be put to death. Jesus is the one who says that in Matthew 15. So it's not as though Jesus is kind of trying to excuse what's going on in the Old Testament. He's one who fully identifies himself with the God of the Old Testament as his agent in the world. And then we look at, if I may just kind of jump in here, we'll look at the topics, you know, does God command us to kill innocent human beings? Are the Canaanites themselves innocent? And what about the commands to drive out or dispossess the Canaanites? You know, how does that square with the command to utterly destroy or leave alive nothing that breathes? And we get into the topic of how this is we see a lot of hyperbolic or exaggerated language that is being utilized in these texts. And so we go from there to look at objections to the hyperbolic interpretation, and also look at some recent cases in international law with regard to human rights in the former Yugoslavia. And we apply some of these rulings regarding genocide, and we say that is actually a faulty label to use for what is going on in the Old Testament in light of these more recent modern-day rulings in the former Yugoslavia. And then we look at things like some philosophical challenges like the Euthyphro argument. We look at the idea of, you know, is it possible for God to command killing? I mean, we wouldn't have indication of the innocent being killed, but we do have, what if somebody says, well, what if innocents were killed? Like in a just war setting, sometimes people who are innocent are killed. Can God justifiably command something if he knows that people will, you know, innocent lives might be taken in the process? And so we look at that, and we say actually that the command to kill, even if it means killing the innocent, is not, and you know, again, is should not be somehow seen as a negative against God, because we actually have exceptions to general moral rules, like when a plane is hijacked and it's going to be used as a weapon by terrorists, and a president orders the plane to be shot out of the sky, even if it means killing innocent civilians on board, it would be morally justifiable. And so we have to be careful about absolutizing a rule saying this could never be morally justifiable, when actually a wide range of ethical schools recognize that there are cases of supreme emergency. There are cases of, there are exceptions in certain overriding cases. And so we also need to consider that. And so what if a good and all-wise God actually commanded something because he had overriding reasons for doing so? Is it not rational to allow for that? And we argue, yes, it is. In fact, in one of the chapters we look at is the whole issue of the role of miracles and how these commands were not given to Moses when he was just in private and there was no verification of these things, which is in contradistinction to, say, someone like Muhammad or Joseph Smith, these private revelations. No, we actually have a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night to, again, repeatedly authenticate the leadership of Moses before the people of Israel. And, of course, Joshua himself, we see the parting of the Red Sea, the parting of the Jordan. We see manna in the wilderness. We see those who oppose Moses' leadership. We see, for example, Korah and 250 with him are swallowed up by the earth for all of Israel to see, vindicating the leadership of Moses and Aaron. So we have repeated signs, multi-century signs and wonders that are being performed for all of Israel. So you have God's stamp of approval of Moses as well as Joshua in all of this. As we go on, sorry to go on here, but I'm kind of preparing the soil, and it actually covers some of the things that I talk about in the book, Is God a Moral Monster? But in the final chapters of this book, we have the topic, Does Religion Cause Violence? We compare Yahweh wars in the Old Testament to Islamic Jihad. Then we also deal with the question, did the Old Testament war texts inspire the Crusades? And we argue, no, they did not. And then we deal with, in the final chapter, the question of turning the other cheek, pacifism and just war. And so it's really a full-bodied work that has gotten some wonderful endorsements from Old Testament scholars like Alan Millard, from a British Old Testament scholar, an archaeologist, and John Goldengay, and Christopher Wright, and Gordon Wenham, and others. So, just wanted to give you a bigger picture of what to anticipate. But I'm very excited about the book, and trust it will be well received.
Yeah, for him, I'm pretty excited about it too. In fact, if you and Dr. Flanagan or both of you want to come back on in October and talk about the book, we'd be more than welcome to have you come on.
Well, sounds good. Let's talk about it.
Okay. Well, let's talk about it after the show. But for now, let's get back to the interview on the God delusion. Now, you Is God a Moral Monster? And I'm talking about the God delusion because one of our friends, Richard Dawkins, has a wonderful quote in there that shows how much he thinks of the God of the Old Testament. And I'm sure you know what quote this is, but for the audience, here it is. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty, ethnic cleanser. A misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. And that's on his good days, by the way. So, it looks like Richard Dawkins has really cast the gauntlet down. What do you think about his opening assessment?
Well, I find it ironic, and this is one of the things I point out in the book, Is God a Moral Monster, is that Richard Dawkins elsewhere denies that there is any such thing as good or evil in a world of selfish genes and electrons. In his book, River Out of Eden, he says that there is nothing but blind, pitiless indifference in this material world. There can be no good or evil, just a good, quote, good luck or bad luck. Some of us are going to get hurt, others won't, and that's just the way it is. Well, if that's his outlook, how can he be so hostile to, quote, religion or any sort of alleged evil, because evil does not exist in Richard Dawkins' world. In fact, he will go on to speak out of the other side of his mouth, and he'll do a BBC documentary on religion as the root of all evil. He does come clean somewhat in his book, The Devil's Chaplain, where he says that on the one hand, as an academic, He is a passionate Darwinian, that through natural selection, we see that certain things unfold and develop, and that this is just the way things are, and you know, there is no right or wrong, good or evil about it. It's just the way it is. But then, when it comes to things like political and social and ethical issues, he is a passionate anti-Darwinian. He wants to persuade people of the rightness of his perspective. He wants to convince people that he is really, on the right side of issues. But yet, he has this, this huge gap between what he professes as an academic and how his worldview is lived out in the real world. He can't live up to the reality of the way things are, given his academic position. And so he has to live inconsistently. The Christian, by contrast, does not have to have this kind of a theoretical, practical, with a chasm in between. No, we actually can bring them together in how God has revealed himself. It's very interesting. I was actually heard Richard Dawkins speak at Nova Southeastern University a few years ago. And I was the first one up to the microphone when I asked him this question. By the way, the audio is available, at a blog. I blogged on this. It's called My Recent Interaction with Richard Dawkins. And you can actually hear the audio on this. But I asked Richard Dawkins this question. I said, in your book, River Out of Eden, you said that we are, there is no good or evil, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference, and that we are simply dancing to the music of our DNA. And I said, if that's the case, how is it that you, as an atheist or naturalist, think that naturalism is more rational than theism if the naturalist and the theist both believe things that have been formed in them by material forces over which they have no control? And Richard Dawkins says, well, it's because science works. And, of course, he wasn't getting anywhere closer to the answer, and he talked about Democrats or Republicans, and again, was not really addressing the issue. And then his final quip did not address the issue either. He said, and besides, science flies rockets to the moon, but religion flies planes into buildings. Now, the problem with this is, of course, that the Muslim terrorists were themselves dancing to the music of their DNA. How could they be held responsible for their actions? You see, the atheistic, naturalistic worldview, again, in which we are simply the products of material, deterministic forces over which we have no control, shape our beliefs, and so we are not free-willing, morally responsible agents, but we are simply thrown into the mix of all these material forces, and so rationality, morality, knowledge, all of these things are thrown into question because the naturalistic worldview has no room for them, metaphysically speaking. Mm-hmm. Unlike the theistic worldview, in which we've been made in the image of a good God who has made us in his image, he has made us as a rational being, he has made us to think about things, to rise above material forces, to reflect on them, to make conscious choices in light of those considerations. So the theist has the metaphysical wherewithal, the resources to address these sorts of issues, whereas naturalism simply fails as you go down the list. So again, that was an interesting interaction with Richard Dawkins that I just wanted to throw in there. But again, I do address that in my book, Is God a Moral Monster?
Well, you talk about how the theist can live consistently, but couldn't Dawkins say, well, you all are living inconsistently because you claim to serve a good God, and this good God is clearly all these things that I've said in this quote in the Old Testament. Why would you want to worship the God of the Old Testament? So, I mean, is Dawkins wrong about the God of the Old Testament?
Well, I find it very interesting that Richard Dawkins, seems to be very hostile to belief in God. He seems to have a certain chip on his shoulder There are others who take the language even further, such as Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris, who talk about again killing millions of Muslims because Islam is a threat to civilization. And so even if it means a preemptive strike to kill millions of Muslims, innocent children and so forth, that they would be willing to do that in order to save civilization. Well, my question is, what's the difference here between what you're saying about the God of the Old Testament and your own elevated modern views of saving civilization? It sounds like the same sorts of things are going on here. I mean, I would qualify some of these differences here, but I think that there's a lot more to be said for bridging the gap. There are a lot of, I think, some similarities here. And when we're talking about the Canaanites, what we're talking about is people who are engaged in criminal activity. These are people who are engaging in, again, temple prostitution, ritualized sex, incest, human sacrifice. I mean, these are things that would be criminalized, bestiality, things that would be criminalized in any civilized society. So when we're talking about the Canaanites, we're not simply talking about, these are just people who are have some sort of alternative lifestyle. These are people who are just kind of doing their own things. We might think it's a little bit different, but hey, that's okay. That's just their way of doing things, but it's not really all that bad. No, we're talking about serious criminal wrongdoing. We're talking about people who are a negative and indeed evil influence to the people around them. And so it is, and also it is a time at which God says, well, enough is enough. And so he utilizes the Israelites to drive them out, in a sense, to evict them from the land that he has promised Israel, but not before they have reached rock bottom in terms of moral corruption. So that's the sort of scenario we're talking about. So when people say, oh, this is the God who does these sorts of things, genocidal and so forth, well, I think that you're actually not portraying this fairly. It's easy to win rhetorical points, but when you look at the specifics, you start to see that they're a lot more, the issues are a lot more complex and nuanced, and in fact, it's often the reverse of the very things that that are being proclaimed by Richard Dawkins and his ilk.
Yeah, some critic could say, well, that's just what the Bible has to say about those who are risen. And of course Israel is going to try and paint these people as evil to justify their actions. Do we really have any evidence that these people were really engaging in this kind of behavior outside of the Bible?
Well, of course, this assumes that we should not take the Bible seriously, that the Bible is to be doubted unless we have some sort of corroborating evidence.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of reminds me of people who talk about the Apostle Paul and some of his claims that he is making about the Judaism of his day. Well, I think Paul was a lot closer to the Judaism of his day than we modern scholars talking about Paul in the 21st century. And in the same way, when you have mention of these sorts of actions that are being done, that these are the reasons that the people of Canaan are being evicted from their land, these abominations and so forth, well, this is a lot closer to the time of what is happening. This is a lot closer to what's actually on the ground. I mean, we do have indications of infant sacrifices as we get to, for example, the Sidonians and mass graves graves where children had been sacrificed, or just areas where you find these bodies of infants that have been sacrificed. These are the sorts of things that are going on in that day. You do have ritualized sex, for example. In fact, you can read the literature of the Canaanites, and you can see how there is incest, there is bestiality that the gods are performing. So we shouldn't think it's far-fetched that the moral fruits, the moral thinking regarding the pantheon of these deities, would filter down to the people themselves who would practice these sorts of things. Hey, if Baal or Asherah have done these sorts of things, well, why not? What about us? Why can't we do these things? And so that's the sort of thinking that was in the theology of the Canaanites. And so it's important for us to remember these sort of things that are indeed accessible to us, that this sort of these sorts of practices are not far-fetched. In fact, God himself is bringing judgment. The prophets are denouncing the Israelites for doing the same sorts of things that these Canaanites have been practicing, like kings allowing their children, their sons and daughters, to pass through the fire, that is, to offer them up as sacrificial offerings, before, say, the god Moloch or whatever. So this sort of thing is going on. It's very, very much a part of the literature of the Israelites, both in terms of what the Canaanites were practicing and what the Israelites were doing in copying the Canaanites. So again, it seems like we have a very good case for the integrity of the biblical witness on this. I think it's also important to keep in mind, too, that when we're looking at the scriptures, a lot of times what people want to do is they will not allow the integrity of the scriptures to maintain that there is, say, a God who exists and a God who judges. They will want to say, well, what if some army came in and did the sorts of things that the Israelites did? Well, of course, this presumes a very naturalistic understanding of things, that there was no God who really commanded the Israelites to do these things. It was actually just the Israelites who were eager for plunder and so forth, that was what motivated them to do that. Well, once you remove God from the picture, a God who is angry with sin and wickedness and who brings judgment on people, once you remove that God from the picture, well, then you basically make the story of the scriptures meaningless. The narrative is basically eviscerated. It's sort of like taking Gandalf out of the Lord of the Rings. You don't have as significant a story here. It loses so much of its integrity by removing this major figure. And in the same way, by removing the supernatural, by removing the God who does miracles and signs and wonders in Egypt, who brings his people out, who demonstrates his presence through manna every day, through the pillar of cloud by day and fire by night over the camp of the Israelites, you remove that, and again, it's just this lame, naturalistic story. And again, we need to preserve the integrity of God at the center of all of this in order to make sense of what is going on. And so we need to, if you're going to play fair, at least allow the story to play out. Even if you don't believe in God, allow the story to remain intact and engage with the Israelites who do believe in this God, who do believe very strongly that this God has spoken, has revealed himself in signs and wonders and so forth, and let that play out even if you disagree. But don't just remove God from the story and say, okay, let's pick it apart without God who commands, without a God who has good purposes for Israel, and it is morally justified in bringing judgment upon these peoples who are acting in these criminal ways.
Well, let's start looking at some specific accounts, and I'll start with one of the favorite ones I often hear, and I'll try and present the best way that I can, but I usually hear from atheists online and in their literature and such, and that's when we go to Numbers 31, and you got this group of people in the desert wilderness, running around called the Midianites, and
right.
God decides to have the Israelites go and attack them and totally destroy them. Well, it's not total destruction, though, because they get to keep the virgins for themselves, which, well, obviously we know what goes on. They keep the virgins for themselves. And this has to be genocide, doesn't it?
Well, that is the argument, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Of course, what we need to do is go back to Numbers 25,
mm-hmm.
and I go into a lot, and Matt Flanagan and I go into a lot more detail on this in this book, Did God Really Command Genocide? And what's interesting is that you have Moses, carrying out God's command in chapter 31, but what is the reason for his carrying out this command? To wipe out the adult males. Well, it is actually because, of course, Balaam, the pagan prophet, is actually giving this inspiration to the king Balak of Moab to basically, if Balaam can't curse the people of Israel, he can come up with a plan to create a treacherous situation, basically a treasonous situation where the Israelites in this act at Baal Peor turn their backs on the God with whom they have made a covenant so that he will curse them. So they engage in idolatry, they engage in adultery, and of course these are two key areas where the Israelites are to be distinctive and to, not to resemble the Canaanites. And here they have basically, it says they have broken faith, they have acted treasonously or acted treacherously, and they have joined themselves to, Numbers 31 talks about this, how they joined themselves to Baal at Peor. And what this signifies is that they have basically negated the covenant that was made with, you know, between God and Israel at Mount Sinai. And they have acted treacherously or treasonously. And basically, what is in question, what is at issue is the very identity of the nation of Israel. That Israel has now thoroughly compromised itself through the instigation of Balaam, this pagan prophet. And this has led to God's anger because they have violated very, very egregiously the terms of the covenant, and so therefore they are now vulnerable to God's own cursing them. God didn't want to curse them through you know, he gave oracles to Balaam and said he was going to curse them, that God was going to bless them. Well, Balaam tried in an underhanded way to get God to curse them through their very breaking of this treaty, again a common form of treaty in the ancient Near East in the second millennium B.C., we see this in the Hittite treaties and so forth, that this is basically followed, that the suzerain or the lord, the master, he says to the vassals or the servants, the people, that if you make a covenant with me, I will protect you, but you must serve me and so forth. Well, the Israelites have just broken that. And again, this cuts at the heart of their national identity, their spiritual identity, their theological roots are now being threatened. And so this is not just some sort of an act where some guys just went off and committed adultery. No, this cuts the heart of what God has arranged with the Israelites to be his God, for him to be their God, and for them to be his people. And so this is now all being challenged. This is all being thrown up into the realm of uncertainty. What is going to happen to Israel? How is Israel going to hold together as the people of God? That's how severe it is. It's sort of like, the language of treachery or treason needs to be brought in here, because it does deal with national identity and national integrity. So what we have then is when God commands Moses to utterly destroy the males, the adult males, it says that Moses, in chapter 31, did all that the Lord commanded. Well, if we take that at face value, if we take that, in a sense, literally, as many people do, then we have a real question that comes up. Where, then, do we have, how is it that these Midianites who have been destroyed now show up in Judges chapter 6, verse 5, where it says that the Midianite army comes upon the Israelites, and it says that they are too numerous to count, including their camels. You couldn't even, there are innumerable Midianites who are coming. Again, this is using the language of exaggeration, we would argue, and that this is something that is, Moses, it says he did all of this, he did what the Lord commanded, but yet you see many, many survivors who are here. So that's one point to keep in mind. Secondly, what's interesting is that God does not command Moses to do anything further, because we're told that Moses did what the Lord commanded early on in chapter 31 in verse 7. It's Moses' further command that talks about these women and so forth. So there is this question, is this even the command of God? And there are various scholars who would argue that no, this is Moses' own command rather than the command of the Lord, because we read earlier that Moses did what the Lord commanded. He finished that. He accomplished that. And so again, I won't go into more detail on that, but that's really those are some issues at the heart of the matter. Of course, Moses said and did things that were not pleasing to the Lord. In fact, he wasn't infallible. and he even, you know, when he spoke rashly at the waters of Meribah, where he, you know, struck the rock. Again, it wasn't the striking of the rock that was the problem, but rather it says he spoke rashly, and he and both Aaron and both exhibited a lack of faith, a spirit of unbelief, and that's why neither of them could enter into the Promised Land, as we read that in chapter 20 of the book of Numbers. So again, it doesn't, just because Moses is a prophet of God doesn't mean that he is infallible in everything that he says, even though generally he has a good track record, of course.
Yeah, but what about the idea about keeping the virgins? Doesn't that mean that they were engaging in rape?
Yeah, okay, that's a good question. Well, as we get to Deuteronomy 21, we see that there is a particular ceremony that Israelite soldiers have to go through, that if they are to take a wife, there is to be a separation, a period of separation from her own culture. She is shaved, she has a change of clothes, her head is, you know, shaved, her toenails or her fingernails are clipped and so forth. And it is to be a time of transition into life in Israel. And it was an opportunity, and again, if a person decided not to marry her for whatever reason, she was not to be treated in a negative way. She was to be treated in a fair way and to be cared for in Israel. But what we have here are regulations that do not allow for any sort of rape. There has to be a proper ceremony that is entered into for marriage. And in fact, premarital sex was prohibited in Israel. That sex outside of marriage was not at all allowed. And that it was the expectation that a person be a virgin upon entering into marriage, unless you married someone who was, say, a widow or a widower. That was the expectation. You know, we read, you know, one passage in the book of Numbers. I assumed my wife was a virgin, but it, and this person claims that she was not, and so there's this ceremony that one goes through the bitter water ceremony. And again, the assumption here is that virginity was an expectation for the people of Israel, that there was not to be a violation of this. We see this early on in Judah. In his life, where he, in the book of Genesis, he goes into Tamar, who is dressed up as a prostitute. Well, he condemns her for engaging in this sort of activity, but again, she reveals his staff and signet ring, and says, well, these are the sorts of things that, you know, to whom do these belong? Well, it belongs to Judah, who himself has acted shamefully. Again, there was not to be this sort of sexual activity. Even with a prostitute, say, outside, there was not to be that sort of activity outside of marriage. So there is this presumption of sexual fidelity within marriage and no sexual relations outside of marriage. That is just the general presumption that we see in the Law of Moses. So not committing adultery is something that we see early on in Exodus 20. This is just simply not permitted. And if one is going to marry a Midianite woman, it is someone who is, again, a virgin, and it is someone who is, you have to go through this ceremony in order for her to become, to become part of the people of God, but it is not at all endorsing rape.
Well, since you brought women, so let's consider some aspects of women that, for instance, in Exodus 20 and 10 Commandments, women can be considered as property. When Caleb wants to give away some land, he offers his daughter as a prize, and then, of course, in Deuteronomy, a woman will be forced to marry her rapist.
Yeah, this is, again, I go into detail on this, and the question is, is this actually being forced? And, well, two things to keep in mind. We see instances of actually statutory rape, where it is consensual. We see a consensual type of rape, although the woman would be, underage. And in that case, there would be some sort of an exploration as to whether this woman wanted to marry the person with whom, again, it was consensual, but again, it was underage or it was illicit. And so remember this, too, that you also have, if a woman has had sexual relations, and again, this reinforces the earlier point that sexual relations outside of marriage were taboo, is that you have the again the presumption that there that if a woman has had sex outside of marriage, then this is a stigma in the land of Israel. And remember too that both man and woman could be potentially again the max punishment was capital punishment for adultery, and it wasn't just the man, it wasn't just the woman singled out as though she was somehow, you know, boys will be boys, but the women, they're the ones who bear the brunt of the punishment. No, it was both man and woman who were under scrutiny here and could be punished even capitally. Mm-hmm. So what we see going on in these sorts of cases is that there is a presumption of one sexual purity upon going into marriage, but if there is statutory rape, then there is the question, again, it's not required, because you can have the father, who is basically the point person in the home, to make these sorts of decisions about what the woman wants. And if she's, if he is a wise father, if he's going to consider the well-being of his own daughter, rather than forcing her into a situation that would be, utterly in opposition to her thinking. So there are judgments to be made. There are also judges who are part of the process, and they are able to enter into the judgment-making process as well. But again, there are these sorts of considerations, and it's not as though this is something that is mandated. This is something that would readily be entered into in terms of common consent before this is agreed to. So again, I think the way the question is framed presupposes a lot about this being forced. About this being simply, any old rapist, and therefore this is what you have to do if there is this, case in which, we do see, say, statutory rape. And I make these sorts of distinctions in the book, and you can look at the details on that.
Mm-hmm. But what about the idea, though, that women could be seen as property, and you'd give away a daughter just for doing a valiant deed?
Right. Well, a couple of things here. As we look, just look at the backdrop of the ancient Israelites back to the creation, mm-hmm. and we see that human beings, male and female, are made in the image of God. Now, there may be certain aspects of human fallenness where you do have, say, a patriarchal society in Israel, and so there are, so you do have the man who is the point person, who is the kind of, in a sense, the legal point person, as well as the kind of the buffer between the family and the outside world. And so there is this decision making that goes on that, and again, the man is the presumed head of the household. Now, this is, of course, we can say, well, we disagree with that. And sure, there is what some people have called a soft patriarchy in ancient Israel. But we also see indications of equality. We can see, in our own day. Let me go back. There is equality, for example, with regard to the fundamental status of women in Israel. That women are equal partners in the life of Israel. In terms of, for example, they are. All Israelites are a kingdom of priests. They are. We read about this in Exodus chapter 19, that they have a priestly status before God. It's not just the men. It is all Israelites who are to be a kingdom of priests to God. We see in, again, Exodus chapter 20, honor your father and your mother. It's not just honor your father, but it's to honor your parents. For this cause, even going back to Genesis 2:24, a man will leave his father and his mother. Will cleave to his wife, the two will become one flesh. Well, there is this equality. We see in the book of Proverbs, both the fatherly figure as well as the mother. The compiler of Proverbs is exhorting this son to learn from both his father and his mother, to take their advice, to take their wisdom seriously, and not to go out running after, those who want to murder and to plunder and so forth. So you have, again, this affirmation repeatedly of equality. And as I said, even in the punishments of Israel, men and women alike were held responsible before the law. It wasn't as though women got off scot-free and that the women bore the brunt. But No is actually very much in keeping with the keeping of this equality that is rooted in the creation. Yes, there were some cultural components, but even those we see challenged. For example, in the book of Numbers, we see the daughters of Zelophehad who have no male heir, and rather than this going to their uncle, they want the heir, the inheritance to come to them as daughters of their deceased father. And so Moses, you know, the Lord agrees, you know, he says, yes, these are right. And so we see, you know, over and over again, this patriarchy is being challenged, in the various things that are being said in the, you know, both in the law as well as beyond.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to another case of genocide. We use a lot in the Old Testament. That's Saul has just become king, you know?
Right.
And so he decides, hey, it's time to go and settle an old score, and goes and annihilates the Amalekites, destroys every single woman, men, women, children, everything. And when Samuel shows up, Samuel's not upset about the Amalekites being killed. He's more upset that, hey, you left some livestock here. You were supposed to kill that too, and you didn't even kill the king. So, I mean, what kind of God are we talking about again?
Yeah, let's take a look at that passage, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
Often misunderstood, but I think we can bring some clarity to the issues and make a few points that will, I think, help show that that this passage is often misinterpreted. Remember, of course, that the Amalekites had been terrorizing the Israelites when they came over from they crossed the Red Sea, and in Exodus 17 we read about how the Amalekites, this nomadic people, attack the Israelites after they're weary, they're not prepared to do battle, and of course the Israelites end up with a victory, but this is a black mark for the Amalekites for how they treated the vulnerable Israelites in this situation. Now, do the Amalekites repent? No. And again, I think that that's an important consideration. There's no making right the wrong that had been done. There was no repentance like we see in the book of Jonah. We see repeatedly throughout the Old Testament that God is one who is willing to relent from sending punishment. But if there is no repentance, if the children continue the patterns of their fathers and don't turn from them, then God says that judgment will fall. And of course, this applies equally to the Israelites, and indeed judgment does fall on the Israelites and also the people of Judah and the southern kingdom. But what is interesting is that we pick up on hints of continued hostility and animosity toward the people of Israel and just ongoing wickedness on the part of the Amalekites. One critic says, well, you know, these Amalekites are just doing what their parents were doing and so forth. Well, they are, that doesn't mean that they are not morally responsible for their actions, that they say couldn't help doing what they did. No. We see, for example, in chapter 14, now this is before we get to 15, where God says to destroy the Amalekites. We read that in chapter 14, verse 48, the Amalekites had just raided and plundered the Israelites. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. So we need to read chapter 15 in its proper context. What preceded it? Well, the Amalekites were already busy at work, causing trouble for the Israelites. So God tells King Saul to utterly destroy the Amalekites. Well, we read twice, one time by the narrator, another time by Saul himself in chapter 15, that he had done what the Lord commanded, namely he utterly destroyed
mm-hmm.
the Amalekites. Now, we're told about a battle that he fights at a particular city where the Amalekites are, that there is this fortress or citadel, and he fights against them. And we are told that there are apparently no more Amalekites because Saul utterly destroyed them. And then what we have is the language of the animals, that Saul kept some of the animals for himself. He first blamed the people and then acknowledged that he was endorsing it. So they kept some of the choice animals. And then so he is chided not for you know, we're already told that he utterly destroyed the Amalekites, so they are off the table, basically, except for King Agag. You know, it's now the animals that are being discussed. And so we see repeatedly that, you know, God does not delight in burnt offerings. You know, to obey is better than to sacrifice. You know, so Samuel is challenging Saul on why he kept these animals from this battle. Then we go on, and we find that Saul, he admits he's wrong, he should have taken care of the animals. Then we go on to read about how Samuel eventually thrusts through King Agag, who probably thought he was going to, you know, get away with things. Saul kept him alive because here is this prize, you know, he captured this Amalekite king. Samuel thrusts him through and says that your own mother will be childless. Why? Because you yourself have made women childless. So it wasn't as though King Agag was some really nice king, minding his own business. No, he had made women childless, and so he was getting the very thing that he was engaging in doing. So that's the sort of thing that you see going on here. So it's important to keep those things in context. Mm-hmm. Now, we come to chapters 27 and 30 in the same book, where we see David now engaging an army of the Amalekites, fighting the same area that Saul did. And we read about how 400 Amalekite soldiers escape. So we see, you know, so people, well, didn't Saul do all that the Lord commanded? Well, where did this Amalekite army come from? Well, clearly what we see going on in the ancient Near East is, you know, you got a typical thing. There's hyperbole or exaggeration going on. And so Saul is one who fights against the Amalekites, and we're told that he utterly destroyed them. But then we see again a whole batch of Amalekites, a whole army, and 400 of them escape after David has been fighting them. So we see, again, they continue to show their faces. They're around during the time of Hezekiah. There's even Haman, the Agagite, that is an offspring of Agag himself. And he's threatening to undermine and destroy the Israelites in the Persian Empire. So we see, you know, the Jews in the Persian Empire. So we're seeing, almost 1,000 years of hostility or animosity toward the people of Israel. So again, if we're going to put this in proper context, let's look at all that is being said in terms of the provocation to conflict in chapter 14 of 1 Samuel, in terms of the hyperbole that is expressed in 1 Samuel 15, and as we read that in conjunction with chapters 27 and 30, we see that there are lots of other Amalekites. So we should not take the language of utter destruction in a literal fashion, because this was not done in the ancient Near East. If you had utter destruction or you utterly destroyed, you could win a narrow margin of with a narrow margin of victory, and still it be said of you that you utterly destroyed the people you fought against. So again, we have to be very careful about misreading this text and looking at some of the other clues within the text itself, and also in the ancient Near East.
Okay. Well, we are going to take a little station break right now so we can get in some necessary advertising and such. But I'm talking with Dr. R. Copan right now, talking about the book Is God a Moral Monster? We'll be back right after this break.
It's here, the official Rock Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite rock radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Rock radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
Check out cyiworldwide.com,
home of rock radio,
free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. cyiworldwide.com. Do you rock?
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcasts, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com.
CYIWorldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com. Home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Can't get enough of your favorite Grok Radio shows? Well, now you can download episodes for free. Check out the Grok Radio program archive at CYIWorldwide.com.
And we are back now to the Deeper Waters podcast. I'd like to thank you for listening. My guest this week is Dr. Paul Copan. We're talking about his book, Is God a War Monster? Now, we're not going to have a show next week because I'm busy with a wedding. Actually, it's some friends of mine getting married, and they want me to perform a ceremony, so I'm not going to be here doing a show. But when we're back in 2 weeks, my guest is going to be Dr. Clay Jones from Biola, and we're going to be talking about the problem of evil and how a Christian is supposed to answer that objection. But for now, we got Dr. Paul Copan here, and we're talking about the morality of God in the Old Testament. Well, let's talk about a favorite one that is often used as well, slavery. You know, I'm listening to Steven Pinker's, for instance, The Better Angels of Our Nature, where he talks about the Ten Commandments. He says, and you'd think that just once the Ten Commandments were mentioned, something such as, say, no slavery, for instance. Apparently that wasn't worth mentioning. And heck, you can't read the Old Testament and know that slavery isn't taking place. So how is it that God justifies slavery?
Well, it's good to read the text closely. And I think that if we see the use, you know, how the term slave is used, we see that it's much different than what people typically associate with slavery or servitude in, say, the antebellum South or the pre-Civil War South.
Mm-hmm.
What we see some key differences, for example, when it comes to the institution of servitude itself in Israel. Mm-hmm. We are looking at not chattel slavery, but indentured servitude.
Mm-hmm.
What we mean by that is that a person serves as an Israelite within Israel in a particular household, again, as a result of poverty. This is not because it's been institutionalized. God does offer all sorts of regulations, rules to protect people from having to enter into servitude by gleaning laws, for example, or when you let the person who's been serving you go in Deuteronomy 15, you are to load him up with provision. So there's all sorts of concern that is expressed for the poor, the widow, and the alien in the widow, the orphan, the alien, and the poor are also included in that the poor are to be protected. Those who are the most vulnerable are the ones you are to look out for the most. And so provision was made for those who are poor. So, for example, if you could not afford the higher-end sacrificial animals like a bull or something, you could offer something on a simpler level like turtle doves. So you wouldn't have to have this kind of burden, financial burden placed upon you through the sacrificial system. So there were ways in which you could have your burdens lifted, but again, sometimes you hit rock bottom, you were impoverished, and you would, for example, Leviticus 25 says a person sells himself into servitude. Well, what does that mean? Well, notice that it's not someone selling someone else into servitude. It's actually a person selling himself. This is voluntary servitude. It's not imposed upon someone from the outside. It's through sheer unfortunate circumstances, through the devastation of maybe having crop failures and not being able to pay one's debts, that one says, well, I'm going to parcel out my family and my tribal territory, most likely with relatives, to live under their roof, to be provided for with food and clothing and shelter. And again, once the time was up, 7 years, as Exodus 21 reminds us, there is a 7-year cap unless you really love living with the person, the quote master or employer, that you live under him permanently through, you know, and you go through the ceremony. But again, this is someone who voluntarily enters into this status of permanent servitude. So that basically you are, it's a contractual arrangement that has a cap of 7 years. And if you're fortunate enough to be living during the time of the Year of Jubilee, if the Year of Jubilee lets everyone go free, all debts forgiven, you know, in Leviticus 25. And so if you've only been working for 3 years, then all the lands reverts back to the original owners, that debts are canceled, etc. So there are these ways in which poverty is kept to a minimum in the law of Moses, and that people are protected from you know, generational devastation economically.
Mm-hmm.
So again, when we're talking about servitude, a lot of times people think slavery of the pre-Civil War South, and that's an unfortunate translation in the Old Testament. Many of our modern translations have this. Actually, in the King James Version, you don't have this this language of slavery, but servitude in the Old Testament. That's very interesting. But let me just draw out a few more contrasts here because, again, of this negative association. How did modern slavery begin? Well, it was through kidnapping. Well, in the ancient, in the law of Moses, kidnapping was prohibited. In fact, it was a capital offense. You were not to kidnap someone. Secondly, if a slave ran away from his master in the ancient Near East and came to Israel, the Israelites, unlike the fugitive slave law in the pre-Civil War South, you were not allowed to send this slave back to his master, but he was allowed to settle within any of the cities and towns of Israel. There was to be protection harboring these slaves, whereas, say, under the Code of Hammurabi, the Babylonian Code, if you did not send a slave back to his master, you yourself could be capitally executed. So we see that difference as well. And a third difference is this, we see this in Exodus 21, that if you knock out the eye or the tooth of a servant, if the employer strikes his servant and knocks out his eye or tooth, then that servant is to go free, debt-free. He no longer has this seven-year obligation. He is to go free. Now, if he is struck and harmed to the point that he's, you know, immediately killed, if the master or employer strikes him and he is killed, then the master himself or the employer is to be put to death. So you have capital punishment. So it's, again, a remarkable difference between the pre-Civil War South and what was going on in ancient Israel, because the, you know, unlike the slave in the antebellum South, in Israel, the servant was not at the disposal of his master to do whatever he wanted with them, but rather there were strictures, and again, it was something that was to be very clearly guarded against, any sort of injury against those who were working for you. Another point that we ought to keep in mind is this, that when we're using this term, you know, Evid, the term for slave or servant, you know, Evid Adonai, the servant, like for example, we see this term, the servant of the Lord. It's actually an honorific title in some places, like Moses in Deuteronomy 34. You know, Moses is seen as one who is a servant of the Lord, and Joshua himself is seen as a servant of the Lord. This title is given to both of them upon their death. Well, what does this mean? Well, the term servant can be a positive, you can be used in positive context or negative context, but what is significant is that the term itself suggests a relationship of dependency, and that is critical to remember. It's a relationship of dependency. We read, for example, in the book of Exodus that the Israelites are slaves or servants of Pharaoh. They're working, of course, this is backbreaking work. It is distressing. It is very harsh and ruthless. And what's interesting is that God says to Moses to tell Pharaoh to let my people go, that, you know, to move from servitude from under Pharaoh so that they may, he says, serve me in the wilderness. So that is, they're moving from one area of dependency, namely on Pharaoh, who was harsh with them, to moving into service to God in the wilderness. Again, not a harsh servitude. So we see that, but in both cases, there's this relationship of dependency. In fact, in Exodus chapter 5, the Egyptians themselves are called servants of Pharaoh. So there is this, even the Egyptians are, servants. There's this dependency relationship on Pharaoh. So I think it's important to remember that you can have this relationship of dependency, but it's not inherently a negative term, as we've seen. Moses and Joshua are considered servants of the Lord, same term that's being used, but again, it does not have that negative connotation. In fact, it's an honorific title. So it's helpful to keep that sort of terminology in mind as we look at these topics.
But when we talk about Exodus 21, some before we go talking about what happened in Egypt, when we get to Exodus 21, we do find that if you hit a slave and they lose an eye or a tooth, then you're supposed to set them free. And if they get beat to death, then you're going to be punished. But it still says, you can beat your slave and they get up in a day or two, you don't get punished.
Yeah, a lot of people will say, you can beat him to within an inch of his life. And, if he walks around and so forth after a day or two, there's no punishment that comes to this master or the employer. Well, a couple of things to keep in mind. We have seen, first of all, that if there is death that comes to a servant, what happens? Well, there is capital punishment here. It is not as though this servant is someone whom the master owns. Rather, this servant has rights that ought to be honored and respected. Secondly, we see that, we take the examples that I mentioned of the slave who runs away from a harsh master from a foreign country, and we're told that he is not to be sent back to his master, but one is to allow him to settle within any of the cities of Israel. Well, that's a foreigner. How much more should it be the case that if there is hardship and distress that comes from an Israelite employer to an Israelite servant, how much more should there be refuge that comes to that person? Again, if there is any sort of permanent damage, there has to be, that person has to go free. So again, this is basically a reminder that if there is, if this person has been struck or harmed, struck and harmed, but not, he wasn't immediately killed. There is benefit of the doubt given to the person who struck him that he was not intentional in killing him, or not intentionally trying to kill him, but acted in anger or whatever, for some perhaps even justifiable reason to be angry, not to strike him, but to be angry. Again, there are countervailing circumstances, things to consider. And remember, too, that there are supposed to be wise judges in Israel who are to make assessments about these sorts of things and to plead their case. And so it's not as though this servant in Israel has no recourse for remuneration, for changing locations or something like that. There are those sorts of judgments. We shouldn't see these sorts of laws as utterly static, and that there can't be judges who make assessments as they see things on the ground, as they hear cases. They can make evaluations. We're often looking at, say, max penalties in Israel, but that doesn't mean that there can't, for example, be lesser penalties, or that judges can't make assessments based on certain complaints that are issued that really ought to be addressed. So, So again, I think it's a flawed charge to say that this is just another indication of the mistreatment of those who are vulnerable. No, in fact, we read repeatedly, for example, in the book of Leviticus or elsewhere, where say servants have been working, well, you need to pay their wages. You need to be, you don't take advantage of those who are working for you as servants. You are to be on guard, because why? you too were once servants, or quote, slaves, in the land of Egypt. So just as you remembered servitude, you are to, from Egypt, you are to engage in a graciousness. You are to let this Exodus experience inform how you treat those who are the most vulnerable in your own society. And so that is a theme that pervades the Law of Moses, and we shouldn't ignore that either.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to remind everyone at this point that what you're listening to, it's provided for by funders and listeners like you. Now, we work in conjunction with CYI Worldwide, so you can go to cyiworldwide.com and promote their ministry there, and there's a whole host of programs, including Deeper Waters. But if you want your donation to specifically go to Deeper Waters, go to deeperwaters.wordpress.com. There are a number of ways you can donate to us there. One thing way that might interest you is you can go to our Amazon store and buy books that if you buy them through us, we get some of the proceeds, including books that we talk about on the podcast, such as Dr. Paul Copan's Today that we're talking about. And you can also go on Amazon and purchase my latest ebook that I've written with my ministry partner, J.P. Holding, Defining Inerrancy, just $4 on Kindle. And there's a new one that's coming out very soon, don't know exactly when, but it's an anthology of writings I've put together myself dealing with the new atheists. I've written them, but JP's helped do a lot of work with the editing and such. And so that one will be out soon. I encourage you all to get it. And then just click the donate button if you want to. And all donations to us go through risenjesus.com, the ministry of Mike Lacona. And send me or Mike an email and say, hey, Nick, I like your show. I like what you're doing, and I want to support it. I want to encourage you to keep doing. And we'll make sure that we know about that, and that way we can get every penny of what you donate to us. Now, Dr. Copan, is there any cause that you'd like people to support that can help you out, too?
Sure. Well, it's not so much helping me out, but I think an important opportunity to give would be to the Evangelical Philosophical Society.
Mm.
Basically, the website is epsociety.org.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Evangelical Philosophical Society does is it engages in an annual apologetics conference, leading thinkers in philosophy and who are Christians, and also doing work in biblical studies and theology and archaeology and so forth. They come to speak at a conference that is put on for local churches. This coming November, it'll be in the San Diego area.
Mm.
We see all sorts of good things happening through the Ministry of Apologetics training that comes through these annual conferences. Great speakers, people like Lee Strobel. We've had N.T. Wright come and speak, Alvin Plantinga, and so forth. Again, leading speakers who are doing excellent work, cutting-edge work in the area of, New Testament philosophy, apologetics, etc. And also they put out a journal called Philosophia Christi. If you are into apologetics and philosophy as a Christian, this is a journal you should not do without. You become an associate member or a full member. You can come to our annual meetings in November. Where papers are presented, where you can meet with people who are writing the books, who are writing the journal articles, who are making a difference in the area of Christian philosophy. And so I would encourage you to do this. There are people who want to come from overseas who can't afford to come to the annual meetings, and so to offer, to give funds to people who are interested in coming but can't afford it themselves. This is a great help to make the EPS more of an international movement, and so we want to encourage you to give generously to this work. A lot of people who are working in the EPS, they're giving a lot of their time and energy, and fundraising is a huge effort. So we encourage people to give to this ministry as it's a vital ministry. It's doing excellent work, has a great vision. We want as many people on board as possible.
Yeah, you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but my fellow bibliophile is my like humorous, but I've been told that when you all get together, that you have several new books that are out on display, and they come at very reduced prices.
That's a wonderful thing, yes. When you come to the book table at the Evangelical Philosophical and Theological Society meetings, yeah, you'll get books at 50% off often. And so it's a great place to do your book buying and also to meet with people who are writing those books.
Yeah, I can already be sure my wife is in the next room saying, I better make sure he never gets to go to one of those conferences because he'll go crazy at the book table.
Yes, there's also the virtue of self-control.
Okay, well, let's get back to talking about the book, Is God a Moral Monster, and looking at charges in the Old Testament. We just talk about slavery, and I always find it interesting when I hear people talk about what God does to Egypt in the Old Testament. Well, first off, they complain about God endorsing slavery. And then when God punishes a nation that's abusing a nation in slavery, they complain about that too.
Yes, isn't that ironic?
Uh-huh.
You have, again, and this is a different kind of servitude from what we see in the land of Israel. We see a brutal oppression in Egypt, but yet, when they are freed, it's as though that's irrelevant. It's a point worth noting.
Mm.
It's kind of like the doctrine of hell, again, however that is to be understood, whether metaphorically or whatever. But people say, how could a good God allow all this evil in the world? Well, you talk about the doctrine of final separation from God, that this is the worst possible thing that a human could experience. Here God is indeed addressing the problem of evil. That we need to remember that evil is not something that is only a present that we need to think about as a present concern. But again, there are future considerations too, that God has done something with regard to the problem of evil at the cross of Christ, and God will one day eradicate evil. And this is one way of, this is one part of God's addressing the problem of evil. But yet, some people don't like the doctrine of hell, but yet they hold against God that he allows evil in the world, and so it's as though God can't win either way.
Yeah. But I can already picture though a skeptic saying, the thing that makes the situation in Egypt different is that God hardens Pharaoh's heart just so he can pour out some more punishment. I mean, isn't that kind of stacking the deck means that Pharaoh's no longer responsible?
Yeah, well, let's check out the kind of fellow that Pharaoh was, shall we? Before we even get to the question of God hardening Pharaoh's heart, we see that Pharaoh is already a pretty nasty guy. So, he is harsh, he's brutal with the Israelites, he enslaves them, Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph, he doesn't want the Israelites to become, to gain any sort of upper hand, so what does he do? He oppresses them. So he's already got a hardened heart. He's already a nasty guy. He is one who is not concerned about the well-being of the Israelites. He is using the Israelites. And thus there is this harsh oppression. And so before God even talks to Moses about hardening Pharaoh's heart, we see that the cries of the Israelites are ascending to God. And it's a picture of God being grieved about this, God being, dismayed about this. And so, what's behind the dismay? The very self-hardened heart of Pharaoh that led to all of this in the first place. So before we start talking about God hardening Pharaoh's heart, let's remember that Pharaoh hardened his own heart first. Does God harden potentially soft hearts? No. God hardens those hearts that have already been hardened by themselves. Does God have to harden a heart? No, he doesn't. God says, we read in Romans chapter 9, God says, I'm gonna harden whom I harden. And so he, for his purposes, he might harden someone's heart. Well, what does that mean? Well, I mean, even a strong Calvinist like Jonathan Edwards saw that hardening was basically God's withdrawing his grace, God withdrawing these influences in an effort to move people toward repentance. God withdraws those and basically says, okay, this is the choice that you've made. I'm going to let you see it in all of its horror. And that's what Romans 1 is all about. God is giving them over to the desires of their hearts. And so basically when we see God hardening Pharaoh's heart, we see God giving Pharaoh over to the desires of his heart. And he is just going to say, okay, we'll let this play out. We'll let you have your way. And then God, as a result, brings about his own, you know, brings the plagues, brings the judgment, eventually brings Israel out of Egypt. So again, it's important to keep that sort of a thing in mind. We do see, for example, God's own, take a passage like, Psalm 81:10, where God says, I'm the Lord, I'm your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Open your mouth wide, and I will fill it. Well, what do the people do? Let's say, here's God is opening up his gracious storehouse to them and says, but my people did not listen to my voice. Israel did not obey me. So what does God do? I gave them over to the stubbornness of their heart to walk in their own devices. Now notice, it says, oh, that my people would listen to me. That's what God says, that Israel would walk in my way. So God, yes, he gives them over to the hardness of their hearts. He hardens their hearts. But God desires that they would indeed turn. We see this sort of thing in Isaiah chapter 5, where God is telling this story of this, the story of the vineyard, where God is doing all of these things for Israel. Israel is this vineyard, these vines that is, they're supposed to produce good fruit. And so God tells this song of the vineyard of how he did all of these things for his vineyard. But, what ends up happening? Well, instead of producing the fruits of righteousness, God, it says it only produced worthless grapes. It says that God had done all of these things, and yet Israel was only producing worthless grapes. So God says, for the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah, his delightful plant. He looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. He looked for righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. And then God says, what more was I to do to my vineyard than had been done in it? So God is basically exasperated at these people. So he's, again, we see this sort of a dynamic. So let's not forget divine exasperation as we look at the question of hardening of hearts.
Well, we've already talked about how the conquest has some hyperbolic language of the Amalekites and Midianites and such. So since you mentioned bizarre laws and events in the Old Testament, let's look at some of those. And a favorite one that a lot of skeptics like to point to is when we come to 2 Kings 2. We have Elisha out walking around. He's just minding his own business. And out come these little kids, and they just say, go up to Baldhead, go up to Baldhead. And he turns, and he curses him. And out come 42 out come these two bears that tear 42 of these little children up. What's going on in this story?
Yeah. Well, the term that's used for these youths, it's the term actually used of Solomon himself, who was not a little twink. He was, well-grown young man. These probably kind of tough guys who are, again, on the younger side, but yet who are very scornful of the prophet Elijah, mocking him, dishonoring him. And now some people say, Elijah was just a cranky prophet. Well, remember that he doesn't have any power unless the Lord gives it to him. So, it's the Lord who is behind this sort of a thing, first and foremost. And so God sends judgment upon these young, young toughs, these tough guys, teenagers, maybe a little bit beyond, and again brings judgment upon them. Again, there are other implications here. There could be some sort of a mockery of him in terms of even, idolatry. You're going up to where he was going, where these places where there was false worship, Bethel and Dan, these calves that had been there, and so there could be some sort of a mockery that is going on that is associating him with idolatry. Again, that's some people might say that's reading into the text, but there could be something along those lines. But at any rate, here is a prophet who has been honored by God, someone who is to be treated as an authority and a spokesman for God, and here are these people who are young men who are scorning him and scoffing at him, and this is a again a very severe lesson to be learned, something that can wake people up and alert them to the fact you don't mess with holy things here. You don't mess with God's appointed prophets who are to be speaking the truth of God into this land that needs to be changed and transformed. We see the same sort of thing. Again, it's a different sin, but we see a very sobering account of what happens when, for example, Ananias and Sapphira try to make themselves look more pious than they really are, more generous than they really are, by saying that they sold their land for such and such, and they actually kept back a portion of the money. And so Peter, through the Holy Spirit, catches them in a lie, and God strikes them dead. And so they are, again, an example. What happens? The church is filled with fear. You see that there is a reminder that you don't take God lightly. You don't take a holy God as though he is to be domesticated and tamed or ignored. No, this is a God who is the king of the universe. He is the moral authority. Yes, he is good, but he is also severe. And if you mess with him, it will be, again, you will come to judgment. It's sort of like Aslan in the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, this Jesus figure, Aslan, the lion. And, Lucy is talking to Mr. Beaver about the nature of this beast she hasn't yet laid eyes on. And she says, is he safe? Well, and Mr. Beaver says, safe? Who said anything about safe? But he's good, I tell you. He's the king.
Mm-hmm.
We see in the Chronicles of Narnia that there is a ferocity, a severity to Aslan, this Jesus figure. He's gracious, he's kind, he's compassionate, but do not cross him. This is the Jesus who makes a whip and drives out money changers for the temple. Yes, this Jesus who took people, little children, onto his lap. He's also one who drives money changers out of temples. And we see that sort of thing in the Old Testament as well.
Yeah, I find it fascinating when I dialogue with atheists about the problem of evil in the Old Testament God, really. So, God should give some sort of evidence that he's out there, that he exists, and then when they're presented with the nature of God, they complain about him. So I'm guessing, even if this God revealed himself to you, you wouldn't want to worship him anyway. And there's this whole idea that God owes me such and such, that God has no right to do such and such to me.
Yeah, there is frequently that sort of a demand. When people are, and I think you're right to point out, is evidence really the issue here?
Mm-hmm.
If it were strictly a matter of evidence, then maybe you would not be as resistant to it. Maybe you'd be a little more open to it. But a lot of times the hardness, maybe the anger, the hostility that you see sometimes in these new atheists and other atheists, and many of the leading atheists throughout history, you need to consider, well, maybe there's something more that's going on here. Maybe we need to ask questions like, well, what if you had ample evidence that there is a God who exists, that Jesus rose from the dead, etc., etc. Now, would you then believe in him? Would you put your trust in him? And I think that that's an important question because it gets past the evidence issue and really looks at the heart motivations and so forth. And,
mm-hmm.
and maybe there are certain theological misunderstandings that people have about what God is, who God is, or they false expectations of, I think God should be this way. Well, those can be unpacked once you, in a sense, clear the deck and say, well, really, is it a matter of evidence, or are there other deeper, maybe emotional or personal issues that really prevent you from considering the Christian faith with sobering seriousness here? So, that's a good point to make, and we ought to press that point a little bit more as we do apologetics.
Well, let's talk about another bizarre incident in the Old Testament. In the book of Numbers, there's a man arrested for a crime, and there's debate in the community. What should we do with him? What should we do with him? And they go to Moses, and Moses says, well, let's go to God and see what God has to say. And God looks at the situation and says, put the man to death. Now, what's his great crime? He was picking up sticks on the Sabbath. Now, isn't this going a bit beyond realistic punishment for a crime?
Yeah, let's talk about that. You know, is this something that is utterly disproportionate? Keep in mind that the law has already been given, that God is one who has already mentioned that it is to be a day in which you cease from your labors. You have the example of the manna in, for example, Exodus 16, where it is you are not to gather or even think to gather manna on the Sabbath. And in fact, there were people who did not gather, and they didn't have, and again, they were thinking that something would come on the Sabbath, and it didn't. And then there were others who hoarded it, and that it rotted. But there would be enough for them if they gathered the day before the Sabbath to have enough for both days. So you have a picture there of, even gathering manna for food is something that was symbolically pictured as, again, this is something you don't do, let alone gathering sticks. So that's Exodus 60. You get to the, chapter 20, and you have the Ten Commandments. And again, this is all, this picking up sticks is something that happens in the context of God's very clear command.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are punishments that come, kind of like Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5, where these can be exemplary, where judgment falls upon someone as an example to Israel. And so you kind of see the max penalty that is given. But again, as Gordon Wenham, for example, argues in his book, Torah as Story, he mentions how the punishments are often exemplary or are given the kind of the maximum punishment. But again, in various scenarios, there could be a lessened punishment that is given. But again, here it is to set an example for the people of Israel. So again, there is dispute upon about these things, and some people will argue, Raymond Westbrook, who had been at the University of Chicago, a noted ancient Near Eastern scholar, that these were maximum penalties. But you didn't have people who were there to, as executioners or something like that, people who were, that was their vocation to do this. But rather, you had judgment calls that are made by the judges. And sometimes, apart from murder, there would be monetary compensation for many of these punishments that were, in a number of cases, capital offenses, but could be commuted sentences to even some sort of financial compensation.
And that's important because the laws of the Old Testament were really what we call didactic, in that they were general principles rather than filling out every single possible exception or scenario whatsoever.
Indeed.
Because, for instance, one thing I've been told, for instance, is that if a burglary is specifically defined as a crime that takes place at night, so if a good defense lawyer has someone on trial for burglary, the first question they're going to be asking is, what time did it take place?
Right.
And if we took even just one of our laws, our stipulations such as a copyright law, just one of those laws could be longer than the Torah itself.
Yeah, exactly the point to be made here, that there are some laws that serve as guides, but again, it's not the Mosaic Law is not some sort of comprehensive law code, but it's simply an example. It gives certain scenarios, but again, is not intended to be comprehensive.
Well, let's talk about a situation described that could very well lead to the extinction of our species in America if we followed it, and that would be that in Deuteronomy, we are told that if a child talks back to his parents and is dishonorable to them, well, that child is to be brought to the elders of the community, and the parents say, "Your little Johnny is wicked and rebellious. He's not cleaning his room when we ask him to. He doesn't have eat his supper when we tell him to. So we just need to put him to death." And that could pretty much cure every young person in America today if we follow that consistently.
Let's again talk about that. Of course, this passage from Deuteronomy 21 is the passage that is actually used against Jesus. That's quoted from being a glutton and a drunkard. That this is a child who, in this context, who is dishonoring his parents. But again, this is not a passage that is talking about not cleaning up one's room. It's not a passage that talks about spending too much time playing video games. And of course, parents need to take control of those sorts of things. Here we've got someone who is older and should know better. I mean, little kid is, again, we're talking about, being a drunkard here. We're talking about someone who is going to be, who is older and is disregarding the authority of his own parents. And, of course, again, this is an exemplification of the, the disobedience to the fifth commandment to honor one's own father and mother. Well, what is to be done in this situation? And again, we are looking at the maximum penalty here. This is something that is exemplary. It is giving the highest possible penalty here. But on the other hand, it doesn't mean that there could not be there may be some sons that are more rebellious, that are maybe somewhat correctable through maybe being put into boot camp or something like that. A judge makes those sorts of calls based upon what he sees in front of him. But the general point here is that this cuts at the very heart and fabric of the family and thus the society, that it is important for children, for young people not to dishonor their parents, but to have a spirit of cooperation and obedience rather than of rebellion and being a menace to society. I mean, you think about this, you've got a firstborn son who turns out to be a glutton and a drunkard. Well, typically you'd have the inheritance, the double portion going to the firstborn. Well, do you want to give money to someone who is inevitably going to squander it on more food and drink and whatever? No, this is something that really is for the broader well-being of the entire family, not simply of this individual. And so when you have something that so utterly disrupts the well-being of the family, this is, again, a very serious and sobering statement that is to be made on addressing this problem that again, this person will not listen. This young person will not listen. What are you going to do? Where are you going to send him? You've got limited, you don't have a juvenile detention center or something like that. Are you going to send him to live with relatives where he's going to cause all sorts of trouble? You don't have a lot of options here. You do have, I think of, in our day where people can, be, in a sense, kind of kicked out of their homes, and kids can be kicked out of their homes at a, once they're legal, and kind of make it on their own without having family support. In Israel, things were much more interconnected, and of course, there's also, there are a number of, shame factors and so on that figure into this here, but again, it is making a strong statement, yes, about the importance of honoring one's parents, of honoring the fifth commandment, that this is a way that God, parents ought to be reasonable too. Parents ought not to be, harsh and overbearing with their children. But on the other hand, parental authority is not to be ignored either. And so this is, again, a strong statement about what God calls on Israel to do in these extreme circumstances.
Can we look at all these situations and say that part of the reason we seem to have such a hard time in our society is because we don't really take the concept of sin as serious anymore. And when I read the Old Testament, honestly, what surprises me isn't the way God deals with sin that I see, but what surprises me most is when I see the self-restraint he uses, especially in the case of Israel, because most of us would probably have been said, oh, okay, let's just go ahead and wipe them off the map already, okay? But he doesn't. He could probably then be that we just don't take sin seriously in our culture anymore, so we think God's over the top.
Yeah, no, you're right. So it's important to point that out, too. I mean, God, you know, we read in, you know, in the book of Exodus, you know, that God is, you know, that gracious, you know, he is gracious and compassionate, you know, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness and so forth. You know, but we also see that God, it says that he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished. Yes, he does forgive transgression and sin, but he doesn't leave the guilty unpunished. And so he will, you know, that he will oppose those who oppose him. And so you see, as Romans 11:22 says, behold the kindness and the severity of God. I think a lot of people want to latch on to the kindness of God, but they don't have room for a cosmic authority in their metaphysical structure. God is to be tame and or tameable, and therefore God is not to serve as any sort of threat to my own comfort, my own sense of well-being. Well, that's not what a cosmic authority is going to be about. You know, I am not the cosmic authority, but if there is a cosmic authority, mm-hmm. then you can expect that there will be some, you know, there will be a, in a sense, a knocking of heads, so to speak, that God's ways are to be you know, followed, as opposed to, my ways, which are can be, you know, wayward and misguided and ill-informed, etc. So again, what we're talking about here is a God who takes justice seriously. God is not only love, as 1 John says, but he is also light, and in him there is no darkness at all. And so we do see a God who is patient. He pleads with his people. He says, why will you die, O house of Israel? He is calling on them to repent. He doesn't want to send judgment. God is reluctant to do so, as Lamentations 3 says, that he sends his judgment reluctantly, that God punishes not because he desires it, but because justice demands that. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of God that we're talking about, not a God who conveniently fits into our own, our own world in which we are the center.
But at the same time, we have to always stress too, he is a God who, as you've said before, he's willing to forgive anyone who sincerely comes to him and repents. And that's Old Testament and New Testament both.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, think of Jonah and how Jonah doesn't want to go to Nineveh. Why? Because he knows that God is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, mm-hmm. and abounding in loving kindness. He doesn't want this kind of a, he doesn't want the Ninevites to experience God's forgiveness or relenting in judgment. He wants them to be wiped out.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of odd. In some ways, it seems like Jonah could, in fact, empathize with the new atheist today, and at the same time, they still have a problem with the whole concept because, hey, God's, God should judge these people, but he's not. He's letting them off the hook. Once again, God can't seem to win.
Yeah, that's exactly right. God is one who sends his, I think of Jeremiah chapter 18, where God says that if a, nation that is, righteous, conduct itself wickedly, well, God is going to think better of what he's going to do for that nation, bring judgment upon it. And likewise, if there's a wicked nation that repents, think of the Amalekites, think of the Midianites or whatever, or the Canaanites, then God would relent if they did indeed repent. But they refuse to do so, and God reluctantly brings judgment upon them.
We're getting into the final portion of our show here. We're going to have about 5 minutes or so. So it's been a fascinating interview. I hope it's answered a lot of questions for a lot of people. But if they say, I've got some more questions, I'm really not sure, I want to find out more about Dr. Copan and what he's doing, where can people find you online?
Well, my website is paulcopan, C-O-P-A-N, Com, autopan.com, and you know, again, there are resources there, and again, books like Is God a Moral Monster, and again, this forthcoming book, Did God Really Command Genocide, that go into detail on responding to these sorts of objections, and I think giving some moral and theological clarity to these sorts of issues that often plague people.
We have a book, Is God a Moral Monster? As I've said, it's available in the Deeper Waters Amazon store right now. And you can find a link to that from the Deeper Waters blog at deeperwaters.wordpress.com. But it's on Amazon for $9.99 on Kindle and $13.31 in paperback for a new book. So with only a few minutes left here, Dr. Copan, is there any final message you'd like to leave today for the Deeper Waters audience?
Well, the theme that we have talked about of a God who is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness, is also a God who takes his claim upon our lives very seriously, and we ought to as well, that we are not in charge of the universe, that God is, that God calls us to a, you know, a higher standard than our own selves. And a lot of people don't like that, but I encourage us to think along the lines of a God who is not tameable, a God like Aslan, who in a rightful way of thinking should scare us, mm-hmm. particularly when we are living in a way that is opposed to his purposes, that, as I said, this Jesus who welcomes children is also one who drives out money changers when they're engaging in practices and attitudes that are utterly in conflict with the nature of the God of the universe, who is both just as well as loving.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would encourage us to think along those lines as we go through the Old Testament, that we not only think of the God who is gracious and compassionate, but also brings judgment when sin reaches its capacity, that God is one who takes sin seriously, and we ought to do so in our own lives, because God is the cosmic authority, and that he is not some sort of evil creator and we just listen to him whatever. No, he is the being than which nothing greater can be conceived. He is a maximally excellent being. And so often we need to bring our own thinking with regard to morality and so forth into line with his, rather than wanting to water it down and make perhaps our own lives more comfortable, but yet being in denial of the moral order of the universe.
Well, Dr. Copan, it's been a fascinating interview with you. I hope you've enjoyed yourself, and I hope we'll see you back here again sometime.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Nick. Great to be with you.
And for now, I'm Nick Peters, the Deeper Waters Podcast. I can remind you all, in two weeks, Dr. Clay Jones of Biola will be my guest, talking about the problem of ether. Well, now, I'm Nick Peters, and I'm signing off.
It's here, the official Rock Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite rock radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphones, and tablets. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Rock Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
You're listening to Rock Radio 2.0.